we're not against rap. We're not against rappers. But we are against those thugs.
What's up, guys? Welcome to show number 83. As always, thank you so much for rocking me these first 82 shows. By now, you know where to find me. If you go to SoundCloud, Stitcher, as well as iTunes, search for Trill Withers, the show will come up. Do me a favor, go ahead and subscribe there so that the show will come to you every week. Got the email address, that's trillwitherspodcast@gmail.com. And the website is lookingupfromthefloor.wordpress.com. All right, for today's show, we have got Good Morning America influencer, meme connoisseur, my man Trill Ballins joins us. We talk about the NBA Finals. We go into Made in America, the O.J. Simpson documentary. We talk some Chappelle Show. We talk some Twitter brands. There's a lot going on. There's a lot going on, but I enjoyed it. Think you will, too. So the next voices you will be hearing are myself and my man Trill Ballins.
Hey, what's going on?
Trill Ballins.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining us, sir.
Yeah, no problem. I did another podcast last night. It was like a Game of Thrones podcast, but I don't think we realized when we scheduled it that the finals were concluding, and so we had like four people call in. It was actually kind of entertaining because this one person called in, and she was just like an expert on all these like Game of Thrones lore details, and she was just dropping knowledge, and I learned a lot, but I was like trying to keep up with the game at the same time, and then check the Twitter feed for the crying Jordan memes.
Oh, man.
That I come across, which I didn't actually, aside from the Aisha Curry cutting the pie or cake with the crying Jordan face in it, I really didn't see any crying Jordan that stood out.
I don't think I did it. The best one I think that I saw was like them carrying the trophy case, and somebody just tweeted, look, they're carrying the crying Jordan into the stadium. That might be the best one I saw, better than any like actual crying Jordan.
Yeah. Well, I kind of feel like it's never going to go away. Like, you know, it's always going to be a thing.
Yeah.
But it really did, in my opinion, like the national championship game this year, just because Jordan was like in the building himself and so prominent on the sidelines. It kind of had a pinnacle there this year.
I was going to say, like, yeah, we knew we were going to meet some diminishing return at some point. And like you said, it's never really going to go away. Like, I just learned that I don't think LeBron James knows about crying Jordan yet. Like, he's tweeting about like the frog and the tea. So I'm led to wonder, like, how many memes is he behind?
He's probably still showing people hamster dance.
Like that, and like Damn Daniel, like he'll get that sometime next year. I don't know when he's going to get Mr. Krabs, and it worries me.
that was like, first off, I'm like, I'm really happy. Like, I enjoy that hat because like more like, if he brings back the slouch dad hat, I'm completely on board with that because that's my style of hat. But like that combined with the Ultimate Warrior T-shirt that probably was like a triple XL but fit him like a small fits me
like an undershirt.
Yeah, like, you know, I get why he did it, and it was like funny and all, but it was kind of crazy because, you know, a guy like LeBron usually comes out like wearing his own like Witness T-shirt or his own Nike stuff, and he just like kind of goes off the script. But I really enjoy it. It's good to have happy LeBron back.
It is like happy LeBron, petty LeBron. Like the hat and the shirt is like I'm the best, but I'm still also very petty. Don't forget either of these things.
He's like truly the first like millennial superstar because he's, you know, he's sensitive in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, and I think everybody is, but he's willing to show it, and you know, he reacts to you know, the kind of chatter that goes on, and you know, if you go back to him talking about his motivation last year, and I think it ended up just being like Pat Riley saying something about like, you know, you're making a mistake, or this is the worst decision of your career, which like, you know, kind of sucks, but like, you know, it's Pat Riley, so
right?
I don't know what you expect. And he just like, he kind of used that as like motivation, and good for him. But like, you know, he's not afraid to say things like take him off and like be petty about it, which is, you know, kind of like the whole point of Twitter, honestly.
Yeah, like it's very refreshing that, and how like he's he's kind of unaware, but I say that as someone, like, we're on Twitter every day. LeBron James probably, I don't know when the last time he's tweeted. Like, he should be behind. He shouldn't be keeping up the way that we are. But, like, him just, like, when he joined Snapchat and just posted the picture of him grinning, or anytime he posted, like, a selfie after a loss, and it's just like, ah, you're so unaware, LeBron. But, like you said, like, that's kind of what it's for. Like, you get that, we get to see that out of celebrities. We wouldn't normally get to see it.
I think the problem was that, you know, he went on that big, like, emo streak. Mm-hmm. Where he was, like, you know, posting the motivational selfies, or, you know, it was the one, like, him in his hotel room. I forget who he was wearing, but, like, he got ripped to shreds.
Yeah, like the Inspector Gadget jacket on.
Yeah, and he just got ripped to shreds. And, like, I mean, that's something a regular person would post. And I think that's right. Why people get on. It's like, you're LeBron James, you know. I'm sure you got, like, you know, pictures of you and, like, you know, the president on your iPhone roll, and you're posting the selfie from the Ritz-Carlton in New York or whatever. And, I mean, it kind of goes back to, like, you know, there's just so many, like, unrealistic expectations placed upon him. And I feel like at least maybe we're at a point where we can sit back and just enjoy what he is without, like, trying to fit him into this need to, you know, compare him to someone else. And I get why people do that. It's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the closest thing we've ever seen to anything as great as Jordan. Well, it depends on where you fall on which side of the Kobe debate. But I get why people do it. But at the same time, you know, he is what, you know, he's himself. He's his own player. Like, the stuff he does is that block last night, you know, just his ability to go across the, you know, entire court in that short time span was just, I watched that replay probably 10 times a day. I couldn't believe it still.
Yeah, it's like that sequence, like, he made the block, which it's got to be one of the best blocks of all time. Like, that's game 7 finals, like, an actual critical moment. And on the other end, if he completed the dunk on Draymond, I think that would have been the best sequence of all time.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that definitely, I mean, I don't know who tweeted about it, but that would be probably, you know, if he had, like, 5 plays on his career highlight reel, that would be number one. Just because of what it would mean in the moment. And, I see, like, everyone's reacting. I don't mean everyone. Like, Skip Bayless is a character.
Sure.
You know, people still argue with him. I get it. It's fun. But he came out, and, you know, his line today was that, you know, if LeBron James was great, he would have shot Kyrie's shot and made it, and, you know, that's the narrative. But he almost did. He almost made that dunk.
Yeah.
And, you know, had that gone in, that really would have been it. He hit one of the free throws, and I think that was it. But I was pretty terrified, like, when he went down for a second, because, I really thought he was really hurt. I mean.
Yeah, I did, too. And you'd never see LeBron, like, roll around on the ground. He usually, like, pops back up.
Yeah, I mean, he usually takes the fall, whatever, pops back up, and, you know, he goes down the ground. And I was like, you know, this is, you know, am I, like, I'm always, you know, I try to, like, not to be too much of a pessimist, and I didn't really have a dog in the fight, but I did want to see him win. But I'm like, this would be the most Cleveland thing ever, right? You know,
right.
You know, like, one of the best basketball players of all time, you know, goes down, can't come back into the game. You know, I don't know what the rule is. Someone else comes in, shoots the free throws, misses them both. You know, something like that. I'm like, at that point, I was like, I don't know. But then, you know, he got back up, and I felt good. You know, on the other hand, you know, if they would have won, he would have broke his wrist. It would have fit the narrative of, you know, he gave everything for the city, which I'm sure ESPN would just be loving that right now.
I was going to say, yeah, but he might actually want to leak that. Like, even if it's not true, just leak that he broke a bone in his hand on that play. Like, just for the narrative, just to make yourself look better.
You know what he should do? He should go get, like, a fake x-ray or an x-ray of someone else's broken hand and then just post it to Instagram with, like, not my business hashtag.
Yeah, just a frog in a mug and just him in, like, a sling and doesn't say anything else about it.
Yeah, just him getting to the, I forget where some of the older memes that he could probably use, but... No, I thought it was great last night. I was working from home today, and I was just, like, watching ESPN pretty much all day. And, you know, they were just, like, loving it. They had all their reporters from Ohio on, and just kept talking and showing, like, you know, video of them arriving after the the airplane from Vegas, which I didn't know they went to Vegas until, like, that point when. J.R. Smith came out without a shirt. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. And then I went on to, like, TMZ or whatever and saw, like, they all were wearing the same stuff they were wearing at XS in Vegas. And it's like nobody slept the entire night, which 100% stand behind, because if you win a championship, you're completely entitled to that.
Oh, absolutely.
But the footage was pretty funny, because I feel like they, you know, they had all the servers there with the sparklers, and they walked them through, and nobody in the club really realized what was going on. And at some point, they get onto it, and they put Cavaliers up on the board, and everything starts turning up. And next thing you know, like J.R. Smith's dumping champagne all over like one of the servers, and she's spraying him back, and just like, good for him, man. Because I really did feel his post game press conference was probably the coolest thing that came out of the night.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, because I mean, I was sitting here, and you know, it's Father's Day, and you know, he comes from like a different walk of life than a lot of folks. There's something you got to appreciate, but like what I related to it is, you know, he's 30, 31. And I don't know how old you are, but like I'm 31. So I'm right at the place in my life where you kind of look back at your past mistakes, mm-hmm. you know, like where you are now, and like you kind of realize it, and you know, you prioritize, you know, where your family's at. And like, that's what I was getting from that too. And it just kind of, it was a really good moment. It was a really honest moment. You don't see that a lot. Especially when teams win.
Yeah.
Normally you get the canned, we gave it 110%.
Yep. Both teams play hard.
Both teams play hard. We're going to go, have fun tonight, but then it's
6 a.m. back on the grind.
It's like, well, that stuff's boring. To get this candid interview that, you know, I think everybody can really appreciate. I thought that was really cool, especially a guy like J.R. Smith, who's, he's been a mainstay of the league and a lot of different lights, you know, both as a good player.
I was going to say, yeah, for good and bad.
Yeah, and, you know, just kind of his incidents with the car accidents, but also, being known for some of his hijinks in the DMs and the pipe DM, which is legendary.
Like the high school quote, like J.R. Smith is one of my favorite players of all time. Like, I was ecstatic to see him win even before that speech. And even after the speech, and seeing like how he celebrated, like how he didn't have a shirt on for the entire parade, and I can't imagine he's gonna have a shirt on all summer. And really, why should he?
He's they've all deserved it, but like him especially. I just think he should just take the whole like Gronk approach and do what Gronk did, you know, during that summer after the Patriots won.
Oh, absolutely.
Where, you know, he just went into that parade and he was wearing the Minions hat. And he just had the Minions hat and he was dumping beer into his mouth. And they're just, you know, in the duck boat. And then the next day he was like in Vegas at his like birthday party or something at the Hard Rock. Just, I can't imagine, like, there's, it probably feels a lot like it feels like when you get off of work at Friday at 5 o'clock, but like a million times better.
Oh yeah.
You don't have to go back to work for a while. Like you did the thing you wanted to do, and you know, you've achieved a career milestone that a lot of folks don't get to. And for guys who have been, you know, something like J.R. Smith has, you know, been a punchline of sorts. I mean, I think he's respected as a player, but he's more known for like the DM, like on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone else mentions that. It's good to see him, succeed. And therefore, you know, I want to see these guys go out and just have fun, because they're still young, you know, 30. You know, go have the time of your life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, I don't know if you saw the picture of Dellavedova was out there in, like a Hawaiian undercover cop shirt, drinking, like, Corona out of a can.
It's crazy. I mean, if I showed that picture to my wife, she would be like, is that one of the brothers of the players?
Right, is that the trainers? He wrapped the ankles?
Yeah, it's like one of the Cavaliers, like, ball boys that just basically got on the plane to Vegas with him or something like that. But, you know, he's living it up. I mean, you think about like where he was last year, right? And he kind of got thrust in the limelight, and it had maybe like a good game or two, but basically became synonymous with the fact the Cavs were missing Kyrie and Love. And then this year he kind of, you know, we didn't really see much of him, but he's there, and he's got to feel good, because he's part of that whole Cleveland lore, and he'll be known as the guy who, you know, gave it 110%, and you know, whatever, like the PFT commenter type of
he's gritty, scrappy, like, hustler,
you know, whatever. But you know, it's funny, because like, you know, he just had that Corona can, and it's like, you're at this club and you guys are drinking Corona. It's like, come on,
Right, like one, you're drinking Corona. Two, it's out of the can. Like three, you're not paying. You know, Dan Gilbert probably spent $200,000 last night.
Oh, no doubt.
Just in the club, just in bottles. And Daly was like, "Nah, I'm good. I'll take a couple of Coronas in a can, please."
I mean, I think some of the other guys had Coronas too. It must have been some like LeBron engineered product placement. He's like, "No, we gotta
these Corona cans. We need everybody to take a picture like holding the Corona logo."
Yeah, well, they just dump it out and pour Sean Don into the Corona can and sip it out of there or something like that.
I'm really hoping like a J.R. Smith Hennessy deal comes out of this. I feel like there's a market there to be explored.
I wish we had more video because I've been to the XS Club once and I saw David Guetta. He has a residency there, and like we got a table at the very back of the club, and when we split it with like 10 guys for a bachelor party, and it was pretty expensive already. So they were up in like that middle DJ booth area. It's like pretty much like, you know, just the centerpiece of the club. And they always take whoever's paying the most money or whoever the most important people are and put them there because, you know, that's the Vegas thing. It's like, right. What do we got? But beyond that video screen, there's like this entire beach club, pool club type area. I'm wondering like if, you know, like, they just took the party out to that pool party area, like 3 a.m., 4 a.m. or something like that. But then they all wear the same clothes, so probably not. But, like, I just it's like one of those things where it's like, I wish I could have been there. Like, I could have been, you know, Del Dova is the ball boy. I wish I could have just been the ball boy.
Oh, yeah, like, you know, everybody was getting it in last. Like, I won a championship when I was, like, 11 years old. And it's still in probably the top 10 moments in my life. Like, I cannot imagine how wild it would get, like, if you won, you know, a championship on the highest level, and especially, like, the way they did it, for the city they did it for, against who they did it against, like, $200,000 might be light for what Gilbert spent.
Oh, no, I mean, just thinking, you know, you could easily get, I forget how much, like, $10,000 bottle of champagne, maybe that's too much, but, yeah, I mean, you have, I don't know how many people are with it. You got to say like 50 people from the Cavaliers organization easily,
right?
Drinking, and then that spot itself, and then, you know, the paying for the service, and I don't know. I mean, yeah, like it definitely was a lot of money. But if you think about it, like you know, Gilbert probably he probably has enough of that.
Oh yeah, it was a drop in the butt. Like hike up some predatory loans or something tomorrow. I'll have that covered.
I would just sell these championship T-shirts and get the residual licensing fee from it.
Yeah, and that, like,
whatever. But it's going to be. I think it's going to be real interesting to see. Definitely what happens in this off season going forward. I mean, with KD's impending decision, and then I don't know too much about the free agency, but LeBron can opt out right this year.
Yeah, LeBron. I mean, he pretty much is. Like, it's in his best interest. Even if he stays, it's still in his best interest to opt out because he would get more money.
Yeah, and I, you know, you got to think in terms of that situation there. I mean, it couldn't have worked out. I mean, I guess it could have worked out better if he would have came in and won it last year. But, like, I mean, he did what he was going to say. He did what he said he was going to do. I think, personally, you know, we talk about LeBron, you know, kind of being a sensitive guy. I think he's a good, I mean, he seems like a good dude. I feel like he felt like he had a personal obligation to win a championship for Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's like the big, you know, tagline on ESPN, but I really do feel like he thought that way. Because it always seemed like, you know, these other NBA players, you know, they have a lot of love for your city, but you don't see D-Wade going back and playing for the Bulls or, you know, anything like that. But, you know, LeBron just, you know, just wanted to go back and he did what he was going to do. And now I kind of feel like he, you know, his spirit has been unleashed to go do whatever he wants to do again.
That's what, like, it'd be incredible to see him leave again, but Cleveland, they couldn't be mad.
No, there's no way because he's a legend there. I mean, he was already a legend there, but, you know, now he's, you know, he's up there at Jim Brown. I mean, and that's...
Yeah.
That's really saying something, but he's up there with Jim Brown in terms of, you know, what he means to Cleveland sports. And again, I'm not from Cleveland, so I'm not the expert in speaking about it, but it's just my perception. So, you know, LeBron could, you know, it's going to be one of those things where, you know, LeBron could go wherever he wants to go. And I mean, it's a completely different situation, but that's kind of how, you know, folks in Indianapolis were when Peyton Manning got released. And as a Colts fan, it's just kind of like, you know, Peyton, you know, this team sucks now and if you want to win another Super Bowl, you're not going to do it in Indianapolis because it just, we got to rebuild.
Yeah.
So it's like bittersweet, and you couldn't be mad at him because, you know, it wasn't, you know, a decision, unlike LeBron, but it's just one of those things where, you know, you got to, you know, once that player is kind of cemented there, you really got to let him, you know, do him and, you know, think about like what he did for that team and that city and that organization. So I kind of hope he goes to, you know, New York. I don't know if that would be the best move for him, but, you know, if he could go to Cleveland and win a championship for Cleveland and then go to New York and win a championship for the Knicks, I mean, that would put him in a different stratosphere, I think, in two different cities.
Yeah, see, I either want him to, like, if he's going to stay in Cleveland, you know, keep building his legacy, I don't mind that. But I, just to see Dan Gilbert sweat, I would like him to sign like a 1-year deal. Just 1-year deals every year. That way, like, if, you know, if Gilbert starts acting up in any way, LeBron can just point the finger and leave again, and it'd be Gilbert's fault. Either that, or I want to see him go back to Miami. I'd just be like, Miami was fun as hell. I'm going back. And I'm going to play at the last, you know, 6, 8 year, whatever, however long he has left. You know, here's the ring that I promised you. I'm going back to Miami. Simple as that.
I would like to see him back in Miami because especially the year or the 2 years where they won the championship, just how much fun, you know, it looked like he was having out there. And again, I don't know. You know, like my perception of LeBron in like the last year is like up until last night, he just looked miserable on that team. Mm-hmm. And in Miami, he looked like he was playing with his buddies and just having fun and going out there and you know, they just kind of, you know, it kind of seemed like a little more loose about it. And again, I don't know the guy. That's just my perception. But I think it would be cool. The thing is like, you know, is the Kermit sipping the tea hat directed at Pat Riley? How much built up pettiness does he have towards Riley? Or can, you know, a new deal with more money easily rebuild bridges for him?
See, after he rebuilt it with Dan Gilbert, I wouldn't put anything out. Like, if he was able to, I think, like, in the letter or before the letter, he was like, you know, we just sat down man to man, had a talk, and that was that. So if he can bury that hatchet, I would have figured, you know, he could get past whatever it was with Riley.
Yeah. Well, you have to think, though, if Riley even sniffs a chance that LeBron would come back, Riley would kind of do what Dan Gilbert did.
He would move everybody.
Yeah. It's like, I'm sorry for saying that. I was wrong. You went back and won a championship. Now, please come back and help me be good at my job, too.
Yeah. See, I think the interesting one for Miami is Durant.
Yeah.
Like, I think if Durant is looking to leave, which he'll probably stay next year because it's more money for him that way. But if he just wants to, like, come east, come to a city, like, in a front office where you know they can build a good team around you, Miami seems to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I agree there. I mean, I hadn't really entertained the thought of Durant, like, too much on that. But, I mean, especially with the way the East is, having LeBron and Durant on the same team would, you know, you got to think Golden State's going to reload and be back year after year for, you know, I don't know, at least the next 2 to 3 years, maybe more. But, yeah, I mean, that would make a lot of sense. I mean, I think you can trust that management more than you can trust a lot of other management teams,
yeah.
Especially in the East. It seems to be, you know, I don't know what Phil Jackson's doing in New York, and Chicago's seems to have been a mess, but Miami really just, you know, both from a living standpoint and a basketball standpoint, would be a good fit for a lot of folks. And of course, you know, Bosch is still there, and I think he still has some juice left in the Cardinals. So
that, or I think KD has to go all the way heel and sign with Golden State, which is what I think I would do if I were him. I would just go all the way heel. Like, I tried it in this farm town for 8-10 years, however long he's been there, and now I'm going to join the Bully. Or I guess they're not the Bullies anymore, but still a 73-win team.
I think if he did that, I don't think it would ever cause as much, like, heartburn as the decision caused, because I think mostly that was because he had the TV special, which I think put a lot of people off. I don't know why, because it didn't really bother me at the time. I thought it was kind of cool. But
I loved, you
know, it. Yeah, I mean, I thought it, you know, I thought it was cool for a player to kind of be able to do that on his own terms. And, you know, never have I seen anything like it. And, you know, I think a lot of the words LeBron used in there, like, gave the critics a lot of, maybe it wasn't there. It's kind of at that, like, big introduction pep rally they had for the Heat that a lot of the jokes came out of that.
See, but even, like, as I think back on that, it's like you just put, like, at the time, LeBron James and Dwyane Wade were Hall of Famers. Chris Bosh was an all-star. If you get those three together, you should throw a party.
Right. I mean, I agree. I think we're like a lot of people, you know, I guess what they didn't. I feel like people might understand LeBron a little more now, or maybe kind of sympathize with him a little more. I don't even know if that's the right word. I think at the time, you know, they were like, well, you know, LeBron's just chasing a championship. And, like, to some extent, that was true. But, like, he wasn't getting the players around him in Cleveland.
Right.
And, you know, he did what everyone else does, even in their own careers and their own jobs. You know, if, like, if I'm not getting satisfaction out of my own job, if I'm not getting paid, if I'm not working with people I like, I'm going to look for a new job. And if there's a better job available, I'm going to take it.
Right. One with my friends. Like, one, it's a better company. It's with my friends. It's in a better city. Like, what? Nobody would turn that down.
But I think to some extent we kind of, you know, we put athletes at this, you know, this unrealistic expectation
that absolutely
they should play for more than what, you know, what would just motivate them as a person, right?
Yeah.
You know, like LeBron sees it, you know, I'm going to go win a championship, I'm going to get to live in Miami, I'm going to get to play with my friends, all this is better than my current situation, I'm going to go. So, you know, I think a lot of, you know, looking back on it, I feel like there's been a lot of, like, critical thought about the way, even since 2010, like, our relationship with athletes and, like, what we expect out of them. I think Richard Sherman might have driven a lot of that, just kind of in the whole, you know, like, these are guys playing for themselves, like, and that's the way it should be. Like,
right.
They should be out to make money for themselves. Like, they should not be out to play for an owner, because the owner's not going to look out for them unless it's some, you know, circumstance like what you see with, like, Tom Brady and Robert Kraft. But, you know, the city's not going to look out for them. You know, they got to do what's in their best interest. And I think people are a little more sympathetic to that now, and I don't know why, but I don't even know if that's accurate, but that's just kind of my perception. That might be just like my bubble on Twitter. I feel like people I follow are kind of in that way, but, you know, whatever happens is, you know, if KD goes to Golden State, I do think that would be the second biggest heel turn than the decision was at the time, because, you know, that's just like full-on, like, you know, that's like NBA 2K when you, like, put yourself, your own creative player, on the best team and right. Just, like, go on and, like, you know, dominate.
I'd be here for it, though. I'd be here for it.
I you know, like I said, like, if KD, you know, like, these guys, they, you know, think about, like, signing a 5 to 6 year contract. Like, if anyone's employer came up to them and said, oh, you got to work here for 5 to 6 years. Even if you didn't pay millions of dollars, there's still other places they're going to pay you millions of dollars, but you're locking yourself down.
Right. And they can send you to another company, and you don't have a say in it.
Yeah, you don't. So whenever a guy, you know, or like a player goes into free agency, like, I fully support them just doing whatever they want to do. And, you know, I think you kind of go back to, like, LeBron and, like, going to Cleveland. I personally don't know if that was really what he wanted to do. I think it worked out for him, but I think there were a lot of other factors that kind of led to it. But, like, with KD, he's not going to go back to Washington. I mean, right. He might, but I don't think the team's in place that's going to get him to, like, where he wants to be. And so if he makes a decision to say, I'm going to go to Golden State because that's my best chance of the championship, and, you know, when I go on Twitter, all people talk about are Michael Jordan's 6 rings and how that's the only stat that matters. Like, why, right. You know, why wouldn't I, like, pursue championships?
Yeah. It's like, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, because David West just, like, opted out of, like, $10 million or whatever to take the minimum with San Antonio, and they still lost, and he still caught the joke. So it's like, you can't win. You might as well get the money. That's how I feel about it.
Well, I mean, like, but that's the problem is, like, at the time, you know, people will applaud the, you know, the move for saying, oh, you know, he's betting on himself, and, you know, this is how players should do it, and stuff like that. And then when they, like, you know, miss out on the money, then they just come back and say, oh, what a moron.
Right.
It's like you can't win.
Yeah, having it both ways.
And I mean, I think, you know, there's such a long view, especially, you know, like maybe not if you're a guy like LeBron who signs a, you know, $1 billion deal with Nike, but if you're just a middling NBA player, like, you really have to maximize the amount of money you make at the current time.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's no guarantee that, you know, you're going to be getting that again. And also, you know, so you can go into coaching after you retire, or you can go into something else, but, you know, you want to stretch that money out for the next 40, 50, 60 years of your life.
Oh, absolutely.
So when you do it that way, you know, you maybe, let's say you play for 7 years and you make as much as you can, like, that sounds a lot of money, like, in the here and now, and it's a lot of money in the long view if managed correctly, but, I mean, I don't think a lot of people understand that, you know, players should be looking out for themselves in that regard, because they're people, and, you know, they want to live, and they want to live a comfortable life. And you see the stories about how, you know, they blow through it, or, you know, certain people blow through it. But I think in that front, I don't know if that's the exception or if that's just like the, you know, most glamorous 30 for 30 type of story.
Right.
So, you know, for every I don't know which player gone broke, I'm drawing a blank, but for every one, do you have, you know, five players who, you know, manage their money pretty responsibly and end up being pretty comfortable for the rest of their lives? So, yeah. I don't know.
All right, moving on to the next thing. O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson, did you watch the Made in America documentary?
I did. I watched part one when it premiered on ABC, and then I got home and I, like, binged the rest of it because I found the whole thing completely fascinating. It definitely is. You know, people were saying it's the best thing ESPN's done. I think it has to be up there. It was really well done. And, you know, kind of where I'm at, like I said, I'm washed and 30. So this whole O.J. Simpson case was like a part of my youth. But it was like a part of my youth from a pop culture standpoint. So when I would watch Leno in the summer and stay up, and it'd be about the jokes and the dancing Itos. Saturday Night Live, they showed some of the clips in the documentary. To me growing up, it was like a pop culture thing. And I don't think I ever really stepped back and looked at the whole picture, like the case and kind of, you know, what led up to it in parts one and two, and really understanding that there were actual, you know, people killed here. There were victims. And I thought the really good thing about this documentary is one of the first things I've seen about the trial or O.J. Simpson that really had more of a focus on the victims and the, you know, the families and kind of the you know, fallout from that. And it, I know, it kind of like made me think about, you know, all the jokes and the dancing Itos and how that everything just kind of got twisted into this perverse view of the case that really just made people forget that two people died.
Right.
So I thought the documentary did great in that respect, and my favorite part, I think, was part two, which dealt with a lot of the climate in LA.
That was my favorite episode as well.
Yeah, but I mean that was the most fascinating, because, you know, that's something. You know, everyone has heard of Rodney King, but, you know, when you sit down and you watch the video and you go and you read about it online, it's just infuriating. And then the LaTosha Harlan's case was something I had never heard about before, and that was just heartbreaking.
Yeah, see, that was one I knew of it. I had read about it. I did not know there was a video, and while watching it, I did not expect to see that video. And right. So I'm like, what is, I'm like, oh my God, she just shot this girl in the back of the head. This 15-year-old girl over like some orange juice or something. And like you said, I think the way that the documentary, especially that part two, played it, you know, it just, I think they did it perfectly. They started with Eula Love back in the either 60s or 70s, and they kind of built up to it. Like part two, I don't even know how much OJ was mentioned, really. They kind of went up like 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all that, the racial climate in L.A. And then it was like, oh, yeah, O.J. And that's what led you into part three. And what I've loved about the whole documentary is Like each part is, you know, a different focus, but they're giving you something you've heard 100 times. And like you said, I'm still learning new stuff. It's still stuff, cases I'd never heard of, things we didn't see before, things I had never seen before. And like you said, really kind of talking about the victims, because like behind all the jokes about, you know, them getting killed and OJ getting off or whatever, you know, they show those autopsy pictures and you're like, damn, like this was horrific. Two people's lives were lost in horrific fashion. And that kind of, I won't say snapped it back to reality for me, but just like you said, you really remember that two people lost their life like this.
Yeah. I mean, going into, I think really part two is my favorite, but when they got to the part where, the verdict was read, that became really the most surreal part of the documentary for me. Mm-hmm. Because that home video they had, that was when OJ returned home and his family was there, and I think Robert Kardashian was there. Mm-hmm. It was so surreal because this is home video from 1995 or 96. I think it was 96. You know, before people really, no one had cell phones. I mean, if you did, they were big bricks. Mm-hmm. They had camcorders, but this video was preserved and kept, and OJ was just kind of standing there, and in some views he just looked catatonic. You just think about how much that was behind the scenes that you didn't see, and the video just kind of served to provide this view that, even after all the evidence was presented and the trial kind of went through, there are so many people that were still attached to OJ. Mm-hmm. And still supporting OJ, and still believe in OJ, and I think I look at the documentary, there's so many bit players that just seem so fascinating to me that I had never really even known. And for example, Mike Gilbert, who was his agent, mm-hmm. had this super negative picture of OJ, but he stood by OJ up until until he went to went to jail the second time.
I was going
to
say, that's what it sounds like from what, he told us. It sounds like he was up with him up until the kidnapping robbery stuff in Vegas.
So, what really stuck out to me was, they had Wendy Williams in, the studio, and OJ was, started the interview off and everyone's really skeptical, but then it goes into Wendy Williams talking to him and kind of developed this rapport, and maybe it was flirtatious, but I really did think it showed that OJ, even with his agent and with people beyond women, really had that charismatic effect that maybe is associated with sociopaths. And he was really able to charm the pants off of everyone he met, and you had a guy who basically had gone through that whole murder trial, and Wendy Williams was apprehensive at first, and then she wasn't, and then now it looked like she was interested in what he had to say, because he was just OJ.
Yeah.
And that was that was just surreal to me, because I just approached it to this one lens that I had compressed time and thought OJ got off, and then right after he went to jail. But there was this expanse of time between 1996 and 2009 that he was off doing whatever he was doing.
He was living it up in Miami, like the prank show. He's like in the club. I'm like, damn, OJ.
When they dove into that, I mean, that was fascinating. I feel like that could that could warrant its own a whole other part.
Yeah, I didn't know any of that. Like you said, you don't really think about what he was doing in between those times. But yeah, it was 12, 13 years. Something happened. He wasn't just twiddling his thumbs. But I really had no idea that he. Went back to the black church for acceptance. I didn't know that he had moved to Miami. I didn't know he was wilding like that. It was just a lot.
I mean, some of the home videos and then the, the excerpts from the TV shows he was doing, the Juiced with OJ, standing on the corner
trying to sell oranges.
Oh man. I mean, I don't want to say, I mean, it didn't make me feel bad for him, but it's almost I mean, kind of to go along with Mike Gilbert, it made me feel bad for his kids. I mean,
yeah.
And I thought Mike Gilbert was one of the scuzziest guys in the whole documentary, just because he had basically stuck by with OJ, and then when OJ came after his memorabilia, he turned on him. But I don't know the whole story there. I think the most fascinating person was Carl Douglas.
I loved Carl Douglas. Like, I'm ready for a Carl Douglas documentary, reality show, pocket, whatever Carl Douglas is ready to give us, I'm ready for.
Well, you know, he had, because I tweeted out the other day that, I think, like, I always like approaching, you know, each of the talking heads in here is like, you know, who's credible and who's not. And Carl Douglas, he spoke, you know, kind of, he was very, he laid out the intent of what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And he kind of made it seem like, you know, we were doing this, and if the prosecution wanted to stop us, they could. And you're just kind of laying out, like, what they did.
Right.
And if you kind of flip it to, like, F. Lee Bailey, like, played it off as in, like, you know, the justice was served and the right thing was done. And, you know, whatever side you fall on, like, Carl Douglas, it was, like, to me, it was a very matter of fact in terms of, yeah, we're doing this because this was going to help our client, you know, win the case.
Yeah. Okay, so if you would say Carl Douglas is the winner of the diet, and that's one of the questions we got asked, who would you say is the loser of the diet, or would you say that his agent is?
You know, I don't know if I'd say his agent was. I felt really bad about Chris Darden, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's the loser. I mean, it's really odd to contrast this with the FX show, the drama show,
mm-hmm.
The People versus O.J. Simpson, because Marcia Clark and Chris Darden were portrayed in much more sympathetic light than in the documentary as mm-hmm. a drama. And, you know, kind of that was the tilt of the show. I feel like the documentary is really hard on Chris Darden. We're pretty much just based around the whole decision to have O.J. try on the glove. You wonder, it's just like, you know, I don't know, was it balanced? I mean, because I always felt like Chris Darden presented himself, you know, very capable. And, you know, anytime I watch him, it seems, again, like it just came back to that glove. And he also didn't contribute to this, did he just wash his hands of it and say, I'm not going to do this? And then the documentary makers say, well, if you're not going to get your word in, we're just going to run with it. I mean, I doubt that happened, but it was just very interesting that he, you know, in a series that kind of presented both sides of, you know, most people, most major players involved in the case, it didn't really seem like he got a redemption angle mm-hmm. as much as some other people did.
One thing that was so strange to me is how, like, as they were doing everything, anybody they talked to, like, not even with the prosecution, but like the cops who were like on the side of prosecuting him, but not necessarily with the prosecution team. And it was like, everybody knew all the answers. It was like, the cop was like, of course you don't do this. I'm like, then how did you all fuck the investigation up this bad? How did you all have all the answers, but like you pulled a blanket from inside to throw over the bodies and you're picking up evidence with no gloves? Like, you've got all the answers now, but when it was actually going on, how did you all mess this up this bad?
Right. I mean, that sort of stuff, I couldn't believe. And then also, you know, of course, Mark Vernon comes off as a complete sleazeball.
He's a piece of shit.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff where, you kind of wonder, like, you know, why, you know, like, that, along with the glove is like, you know, this just wasn't vetted, it seemed like, or it just wasn't a, you know, complete, you know, decision to critically thought out decision to go with it. But you know, like the thing that's like really weird for me is, you know, I feel like we've reached a point in like 2016 where like DNA evidence is so conclusive in terms of like influencing the mind of a jury. And, you know, it was the whole like DNA movement and just like such the start of it, or the front end of it, that it just wasn't a convincing argument at the time. And again, that's not enough to fully convict someone, obviously.
But mm-hmm.
that's the thing that always sticks out to me is like, you know, you had the blood inside the Bronco, you know, of you, Ron Goldman, and Nicole, and, it seemed like that would be enough to, you know, pin someone down. I think that was the argument when the initial, I guess, questioning of OJ was going on by the detectives, where, you know, Marsha Clark was saying, why didn't you ask him this and why didn't you ask him that?
Right.
I think that was kind of the major fault there. But yeah, I mean, I think you have a really good point. There are just so many, there are so many fuck ups along the way that, like, you know, that's why I like Carl Douglas, because he was just kind of laying it out and saying, they didn't do this, they didn't do that. And you realize it, and it's just, it's kind of unbelievable, because you don't think in like 2016 that, I guess with, you know, all the social media and pictures and videotaping, that like anyone would even risk touching evidence with gloves and being caught, or, you know, being caught on camera, or, you know, giving, you know, false statements, because you could easily Google, you know, what that person said and pull it up in public record in a second.
Like that, and the another like overwhelming thing I kept thinking about during the documentary, like every time they talk to either of the jurors, I think they talked to two of the jurors, and it's just like hearing them talk, and I'm like, Jesus, like I hope I'm not ever in a position where like a regular human being would have a decision over my life. Like on every day on Twitter, we see how stupid people are. And it's like one of these days, one of these people are going to be in the jury, and they're going to decide whether you get off scot-free or do 146 years in prison. And yeah, that's terrifying to me.
I mean, you got people out here on Twitter that, you know, want to celebrate the death of a kid by alligator.
Right. And so, these are the people that are going to be on your jury.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, like that's terrifying. And then, you know, also like I think the civil aspect of it, from the standpoint of, I guess, the Goldmans, was terrifying too, because they won, but OJ just didn't really have a mechanism to reliably pay them back.
Right.
So you think about that, like the, you know, the pensions, it couldn't be used for repayment, and then OJ was also, I don't know, like filtering or laundering or, you know, whatever the term is. He wasn't, you know, accurately reporting his income as to avoid it. So, you know, that whole part was really fascinating, because it was a, you know, very large number, like 38 million, but it, you know, ultimately, like you said, it was just a piece of paper. But you kind of think about, like, yeah, like you got people who would, you know, not make an intelligent decision about your, you know, are you going to spend the next 30 years of life in prison or not? But you also have, you know, jury case on the civil sides that, you know, decides on the preponderance of the evidence whether or not you're going to be in debt your whole life. It's like right. So even if like, let's say you get out, like if they decide the civil thing, like, well, now I got paid $15 million, you know.
Right, for the rest of your life.
Yeah, so I mean, it's just that you think about it, like, yeah, it's like so much of it's based off of like people's perceptions and their own you know, their own preconceived notions of, you know, wrong and right. And I think in a lot of sense, like, you know, that part two really did a good job explaining the climate of the times and, you know, why it led to the way it led.
Yeah.
And I, you know, again, like, justice for one person isn't necessarily justice for another person. And right or wrong, good or bad, it just is. But yeah, I think that, like, the documentary did a good job, like, making people think about that, and that's always obviously what you want out of these things, to, you know, learn something new or to approach something from a different angle, and it certainly was effective from that standpoint.
Yeah, definitely. And again, with a case that's been done so much, like I feel like everybody knows at least something about OJ. And then again, you had the FX series earlier this year, you had this, and I've heard, I think it's Martin Sheen is doing some type of OJ Simpson documentary for later in the year. And so it's like people keep doing this. I don't know how much, you know, more mileage you're going to get out of it, especially after this ESPN one. Like, I don't know what else you could uncover that wasn't uncovered. But
right.
Yeah, but with something that's been going on for 20 years, people are still talking about it, still making jokes about it, and still doing like brand new documentaries about it. And it's interesting. It's just interesting.
I think the most interesting thing to me is like OJ is going to get out in 2017. So, you know, he's coming back, and like in what capacity, like, we don't know. But you know, like, what, you know, what's OJ going to do with his life? You know, and then you got like just the weirdest thing is, you know, like the Kardashian whole side of that relationship. You had the news this week that OJ was going to agree to a paternity test with Khloe, and, you know, it's just the timing so odd for this, you know. And I know my tinfoil hat is that it's just a big publicity stunt, you know, one of Kris Jenner's schemes. But you know, like you got all this stuff coming out this year, and then OJ's going to get out, and you got to think that's going to be, you know, the interest and that's going to be reignited, especially after all these you know, shows and documentaries come out. Like, you know, what's he going to do? Where's he going to go? And you got Ron Goldman saying he's going to follow him the rest of his life. Like, you got to wonder if it's not going to end.
No, I guess the same exact thing. I was like, they're like, again, I'm a tinfoil hat guy. It's like, why would they do all this if he's going to get out next year? Like, this, it can't be an accident. It can't be. Like, the Kardashians could have been used his name for, you know, some kind of press. They could do it like every year, and people eat it up every year because we see right. How interested people still are in O.J. Simpson. But when he gets, I think we should jump him. Honestly, I think, like, we should all just band together and try to jump O.J. Simpson. Like, he's not a good person. I think we should jump him.
Well, the funniest thing to me is O.J. Simpson agreeing to a paternity test means that Khloe reached out to him. Khloe probably talks to Kris, and Kris probably, I mean, assuming it's all real, Kris has had sex with O.J., right? So at least we know at the bare minimum O.J. has smashed, right?
Yes.
So that's the most fascinating part of all, because they've always maintained, and I looked this up the other night, they've always maintained that they had a friendly relationship, but Kris would have had, I think, to cheat on, actually, I don't know, but I think cheat on, you know, Robert or Bob Kardashian or whatever.
I think, yeah, because, I mean, that was what, Khloe's what, 30s? So that was what, mid-80s? They had to have been together then.
Yeah,
I mean, and she's like the youngest, or one of the youngest.
Yeah, I think so. I think she's either the youngest or older than Ken. I can't remember, but yeah, I mean, I think that either was at the tail end. So you know, you kind of think that, like, all this is just kind of Kris, you know, planning this very special episode of the Kardashians after all this OJ interest has been, you know, drummed up by all this documentary footage. And, like, I got to be honest, like, if they're going to do the reveal, like, that's going to be the first time I'm going to watch the Kardashians.
I was going to say, I'd be in for it. Like, I would.
And not only would that be good TV, that'd be good Twitter.
That'd be excellent Twitter.
Crying Jordan on Khloe when she finds out the results.
It's just Kris, Mr. Krabs. She's got the fuzzy background around her. What do you think would make for, like, the biggest Twitter day? Like, just, it could be, it'd have to be OJ, it'd have to be sports. Like, just what happening?
Oh, man. I this is kind of morbid, but I really
feel God.
Like,
here it comes.
I'm not going to call anyone out, but, like, I really feel like the most activity on Twitter is when, like, a major celebrity dies.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, I hate when it happens, especially when it's, you know, obviously when it's people that you like, and, like, we've been going through it a lot in 2016.
Yeah.
It always feels like, you know, that sometimes it's, like, the best time to be on Twitter because everyone's getting along and kind of, like, mourning together, but then eventually someone, like, comes out and says, like, you know, David Bowie is problematic, and then everyone starts fighting again.
Right. Y'all wouldn't listen to Prince. Y'all didn't care about Prince 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. So, like, I kind of feel like, like, before this year, I would have said, you know, it would be, like, the death of, like, a major, you know, pop culture figure. But, like, we've had that. And it, you know, while they were sad days on Twitter, it wasn't like it was when, like, Michael Jackson died.
Yeah.
I remember that because I was, like, kind of on Twitter, kind of off of it. And Twitter wasn't as big then, but, like, that, all that news was, like, breaking off of Twitter, right? And that was kind of, like, at the infancy of, like, TMZ had been around, but, like, this was when they just started getting into, like, being the one breaking source for these sort of things.
Yeah.
So that like, pretty much, I mean, I don't remember if, like, they took down the servers or whatever at the time, but that was a pretty big day. I would have to say, though, that the biggest day to be on Twitter, I mean, like, yesterday, like, might have come close. I would say, you know, anytime you have, like, a Super Bowl or a Game 7, and then you combine it with, like, a major television show event, like, you got multiple things working at once. But now it just almost seems like every day is blended into each other, which...
For better or worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's, like, especially last week with what, like, went on with that, that, you know, woman, you know, in the alligator tweet, you know, started off and everyone was ridiculing her, and then they drove her off Twitter, and then everyone just kind of, you know... I guess they said, like, they told their employer on her, which is, like, not cool and all that. And they just say, you take something where it's kind of like, okay, this is ridiculous, but then you take it in the opposite direction where it just doesn't seem like it's fun anymore. So I don't know what would be big. I mean, I like the LeBron thing because it seems like it's something that, like, everyone can really get around. And, you know, most folks were happy for him. And, you know, Golden State fans probably weren't happy for him, but they were happy a few years ago when they were Heat fans. So.
Right. I would say, like, last week just in general was just a horrible week, like, in general and on Twitter. It was, like, the alligator shit, the Orlando shootings, like, the Pulse Club shooting and the singer from The Voice getting killed. And it was, like you said, it was just, like, you start to, like, we're, not there's going to be fun in those situations, but it's, like, we're taking shitty situations and taking them, like, even further into the abyss. And it's, like, for what? What's the point here? What are we getting out of this?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, there's, like, with something like the Orlando shootings, I feel like things have almost gotten, like, more toxic, and I don't know if that's because of, like, what's going on with the political environment, but, you know, there's just a lot of, and I guess, like, you know, when I first started out, like, tweeting, I, you know, I'd find, you know, ignorant tweets or whatever, and I'd retweet them and kind of say, haha, look at this idiot. Mm-hmm. And then you just realize, like, all you're doing is looking for that shit yourself, and you're just making yourself sad that someone's saying it. You're just giving that person a platform and broadcasting them. And then you're giving other people the ability to hop in their mentions. And when people are, like, accosted like that, they're just going to double down.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, most people are not going to have their minds changed on Twitter, much less their minds changed ever in real life. Like, I think intelligent people are willing to have the debate, kind of think about stuff and move. But, you know, like, last week was just especially bad because you just had this, you know, it was like really like a buildup of the, like, Harambe. Event. And you kind of look back and it's like, you know, everything was going so well that we were arguing over, like, that. And, like, yeah, that was unfortunate, but, like, it's almost like one of these things where you have to take a binary stance. It's like you can't really read between the lines or see the shades of gray. And, like, these situations are, like, not binary. Like, there's no winner there. Right. Like, the kid had to live, and I'm sorry the gorilla had to die. I'm not happy about the gorilla dying. And, you know, kind of, you know, one side was like, well, it's not justified. The gorilla should live. And it's like, well, what are you advocating for? Well, not that. It's like, why are we talking?
Right.
So then you move into next week and you kind of had that, like, you know, that tension. And then I don't think it, like, yeah, it just wasn't a good week. It's like one of those things where I don't think, like, the election has really helped it, and the rhetoric that's coming out of, like, Trump and you know, whatever. It just seems like lately it's been a little more toxic, but again, I'm still tweeting, so it's not like it's driven me off, so it's probably my problem. But I don't know if you have that perception too.
I do, and it's something I was gonna ask you. It's like I felt the same. It's like I feel like there's a certain level to where you can probably retweet and point out something, you know, problematic and talk about why it's problematic. But then once you reach, like, a certain, it sounds strange, like a certain number of followers, you feel like you're doing more harm than good.
I agree with you completely. I was gonna say,
is that something, like, you've experienced? Because I know you've taken off here recently. You're a superstar now, man.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely some of it I've experienced. And I think I don't like to do that anymore, because I think my thing is, like, if I ever interact with somebody and, like, I'm, like, quote-unquote trolling them, like, I want them to feel like I'm the stupid one and they're making fun of me.
Right.
So, you know, anytime, you know, the Magic Jackson stuff, and, like, anytime people, like, I think that's pretty clean. Like, people are just correcting you, and, like, you keep going with it, and they think you're a dumbass. I'm good with that. But I used to find that stuff. I used to try to get in debates with people, but at a certain point, you're not going to change people's mind. And at the worst, you're going to take your 20,000 followers and broadcast your fight to them, and you're going to have people hop in there, and, like, it's that person is just going to feel like they're piled on. And I think it's only going to make them, you know, entrench themselves in their stance more, because now you're making them, you know, a double down. Like now I'm being attacked for my beliefs, or now you're silencing me or whatever. It's, So it's just not like, it's not completely productive, I don't think. And it's something I've had to deal with because, you know, even some like pretty innocuous stuff I've retweeted and I'll get like, you know, 5 followers who will say something back. And like, I understand.
Right.
You know, it's all game, right? Like, I mean, when you're coming up on Twitter, you know, you want to tweet at people and be funny and make people laugh and make people with a lot of followers laugh. And like, you know, I understand that, but you know, sometimes when it's at the expense of other people, it doesn't seem like it's fun anymore. It just seems like it's mean.
Yeah, and it feels like you're enabling you're opening them up. Like, hey, everybody, look at this. And not in a way to be productive. Like, hey, you've got a problematic, you know what I'm saying, point of view. Let me show you the other side of it. It's just kind of, hey, everybody, look at this, you know, this egg Abby saying whatever. And like, how are they ever going to get that message out to their 82 followers, you know, until you come along? And that's when it feels like, should I even really give them the platform?
No. I mean, and it's gotten, you know, it's obviously gotten a lot worse with the quote tweets, I think.
Yeah.
Because now people can directly read what you're saying and they can read what they're saying. And then a click is going to get them responding to both of you. Whereas like, I mean, you could have responded to the person before and put a period before it, but that just means someone scrolling their feed has to go to the effort to read what you had previously said.
Right.
That doesn't sound like a lot of effort, but like when you're on your phone and you're sitting on the toilet, like,
I would say, yeah, over the course of how much we're on Twitter, you know, 15, 18 hours a day, it's a lot of scrolling.
Yeah, so it's right there, and if I can read both tweets and then reply and then instantly, you know, snap off my comment, then like that's nothing to me. Yeah, so, you know, whenever a Twitter user has like 82 followers, or, you know, just like 300 or something like that, and you don't know them, and, you know, like 15 notifications to them might feel like overwhelming, whereas like I deal with like 100, just a sea of garbage tweets. Like, I'm used to it. Like,
right.
Other people might not be. And, like, you know, you don't want to, I guess I've changed. I don't want to make people feel like they're being attacked or anything like that. Because there's just, you know, there's enough of that going on in Twitter anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, like where I was, you know, I had 500 followers and I, you know, would tweet at brands and kind of, you know, try to say dumb things to them. And I go out and find dumb people and highlight them. But it's just, you know, I still like the brand thing. But like, you know, interacting with people, you just like want to keep it tight to just the people you like to interact with mostly. Because, you know, you only have like a finite amount of mental energy to waste on this thing. And it seems like it's better just to try to keep it positive most of the time rather than going out of your way, because, you know, you could spend an entire day trying to find all the, you know, horrible crap people say on Twitter and not even get through, you know, half 1% of them.
So, okay, so on a more positive note, what is your favorite brand that you've done?
Oh, I liked, my favorite brand, I probably like the anything like NFL, NBA Insider. Or, I did like NBA or NFL Insider Adnan Schefter.
That was a good one.
Yeah, it was a play in like Adam Schefter, and like, yeah, I like the, I just think I like doing is it's just so stupid. You just like say a piece of NBA news and then you just repeat like a fact from the Serial podcast. So it's like, yeah. Peyton Manning's retired today and I'm in jail still. Like, crime that is unresolved, basically. It's just so stupid that I just enjoy that. And like, there's just a lot of it. I mean, like, really, what I'll do is like, I'll just be sitting there. So like, I do like coding, right? So I'll like do code and I'll like wait for it to run. And so, you know, like while I'm doing that, you know, I just have all these creative impulses that like aren't being satisfied by, you know, the computer screen, and
sure.
I'll just be like, okay, like, you know, what if, what if Barbaro the Dead Horse was a WWE expert, and I just like put it together.
My favorite one, and I think it's by a pretty considerable margin, was September 10th, 2001 guy. Like, I've never like simultaneously laughed at something, been like, don't do this, man, reconsider, but keep going, but don't do this.
That was actually, do you follow Fansons 09?
Yeah.
That was actually his idea. like at the time, you know, he had just, you know, he's a good dude, but he had just, like solved that crime, you know, like been on The View for all that stuff in Philadelphia. And he like gained all these followers that like, you know, the problem with you get a lot of followers is you get a lot of people walks of life who like may not necessarily get the humor. So they're like, hey, it's a really good idea for a brand. But like, I have 14,000, you only have 6,000 now. So like, can you do it? I'm like, yeah, sure. Like, fuck it. Like, I'll do it. And so like went forward with it. And, you know, just like, I think the first tweet was like, everything is fine.
I remember that. I remember it was like something happened, was like spilled my coffee. There's no way this week could get any worse.
Right. It was just like, because I remember, like I was a sophomore or a junior in high school, and the day before, like I was a huge nerd, so I was like big into Counter-Strike and computer gaming. So like September 10th, like my CRT monitor went out, and like I was like super pissed about that. Like I'm like, oh, my monitor broke. So like that day,
what else could go wrong?
Yeah, I like took it into CompUSA, and then like the next day happened, which is like the, you know, the worst thing I've seen in my life. And you know, it's just kind of like you reconsider, you know, like the magnitude of your problems. And so like the whole idea behind that brand was just like, you know, it seemed like, you know, obviously everything has changed so much since then. And, you know, when I look back at that like day before, when I was thinking like I was working, like worrying about my computer monitor, it was just like, it just seems so freaking silly.
Yeah. I think like that was kind of like the, like that was really the humorous part. Like you weren't poking fun necessarily like at the people like right before that, but just hearing those things like, it was like the Jay-Z CD is coming out this week. This is going to be the biggest thing to come out of New York this week. That's for sure.
Right. Well, it's just like that. It's that, you know, that inflection point in history, and it's just a general point where like everything seemed a lot less complicated, right? And that, I mean, that's probably a matter of nostalgia now, because you know I was in high school, and like what's really complicated then. But you know, like looking back, you know, before that, it was you know, obviously a turning point in, you know, the way the last 15 years have gone. So I think like for that brand, it's like, yeah, you know, I remember what else was like coming out that year? I think like I got like a PlayStation 2. I was like really stoked about that, and like everything else happened, and it was like this transition into, you know, adulthood, where now you know, you realize there's a bigger picture to the world. And like that really, I mean, everyone has their own story about like where they were when, you know, big events happened. But I think that's kind of what, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, made it funny was everybody can, you know, who's maybe like 25 to 30 can think back to their life and where they were. And say,
right.
Okay. Yeah. Things were like a lot less complex.
I'm trying that. Yeah. Magic Jackson. I was a big fan of Magic Jackson. So all the brand, like, do you get them from people, or you think them up, or some of both, or you just got it like as they come, you just go with them.
So yeah, like Magic Jackson was, the thing about Magic Jackson was I wanted to do this thing where I do like this NBA player ranking list, right? And you know, the first one would be LeBron James. And this was back when I think LeBron was still with the Heat, so it's like this ridiculous notion, blah blah blah. Now, second one's Michael Jordan, right? So the first thing people say is, okay, this list is completely ridiculous. So what I wanted to see is how many people would look at that list and just see LeBron and Michael Jordan, and then manual retweet it and say, this list is ridiculous, so LeBron sucks, while having Magic Jackson still be in there. Like, you had this like unreliable like person ranking the list, but you still want to debate it, which is kind of like gets back to, you know, a lot of the discussions that happen on Twitter, where like the person you're talking to is most likely a complete moron, but you're still arguing with them,
and also going to be on your jury.
They're going to decide whether or not you go away for 30 to life or whatever. But you're arguing with them like, you know, you're going to change their mind. Like, no, Jordan's the best, and here's the reasons why. Like, okay, you know, thanks, guy with, you know, dog avatar, lacrosse man 69. Really changed my like perspective. Yeah, but like, you know, like a lot of them, they're just like, it's fun because, you know, like PFT commenter is like, I've talked to him on and off, and like, you know, he's a good online, you know, like buddy. And like, I think he's done a really good job. But like, one of the things I really feel for him is like, he's been doing the same, I don't say shtick, but like, you know, he plays a character and is entertaining, but he's been doing it for years.
Right.
And, you know, the thing that like, and you know, I wouldn't mind doing that, but like what I think would get tiring is like people expect like a certain thing from you, right? So like, if you want to try something new or wanted to make a different joke, people would say, oh, he sold his account because that's different,
right? Like,
or whatever. So like, at least you know, when like I can change the brands, like, yeah, like he has like 121,000 followers and has a job doing what he's doing. So it's not like on the same magnitude, but like, I just like the fact that like I'm on there for fun. I can change it up. If I get bored of something, I can change it up. A lot of times I'll do something, make two tweets and realize how unfunny it is. And I'll just be like, that sucked. So,
I feel like that's part, like, we get to see, like, you work, like, the rough draft and everything.
Yeah, well, I might tell people, like, I'm a volume tweeter, man. I'm like Kobe in his last game, and
yeah, that's how I feel. Like, you look up and I've got 50 points. Just don't notice that I took 58 shots.
Yeah, you know, and you're going to look at Kobe and you're going to remember 81 and you remember 60, but, like, you know, kind of like you remember the best things that happened, but you don't remember, like, all the trash brands like Matthew LeBron Hay. There's like really nowhere to go with that. I met McConaughey and LeBron. Like, that's end of joke.
I'm trying to. Somebody had asked if you could BOFA anyone, dead or alive, who would it be?
BOFA?
Yeah. Yeah. If you could BOFA anyone.
Oh man. I think it would be Richard Dawkins.
That'd be perfect.
He was BOFA.
Did he? Did they get him?
Yeah, I think it was a Fire Scott, Fire Scotch or something like that. But yeah, it was like. I mean, there's so many funny chains involving Richard Dawkins because he'll entertain anybody. It was like one of those things. It was like maybe 20. I forget what it was. Like, BOFA wasn't quite like oversaturated, but it was getting there. Mm-hmm. And I still appreciate a good one if it's, like, at least, like, somewhat of importance. But if you're just trying to, like, BOFA the, like, you know, Cheetos Arabia account or, like,
right,
you know, that wasn't a big deal. But, like, Richard Dawkins was, you know, talking to someone, you know, I think that this guy said, what about the BOFA report, which is, like, a really go-to one now. He just said, oh, I'm sorry, I haven't heard of that. And then, you know, hit him back with the four-panel dunk Death Star blowing up, like, whatever. I thought that was pretty entertaining because, I mean, he's such a, I mean, his Twitter presence is like, he takes everything so seriously. Like, someone had, it was like Virgil Texas that said, hey, can you unblock me? I have something extraordinary to tell you. And like, he got him to unblock me. And then after he did that, he said, okay, I've unblocked you. What is it? And he just said, God is real. That's all. Like, Richard Dawkins entertains it, and I think that's what makes it so ridiculous. Is you got this guy who, in my opinion, like, used to be like pretty respected for that particular field or whatever, and then his Twitter persona has completely like ruined him because he's like been exposed as being like misogynistic and all these other things. Like, that's the never tweet philosophy right there.
Yeah, you got to either like go out on top or just never start. Because like you said, like with him and like what makes the BOFA so good is like if you get that response out of Richard Dawkins, he has no idea what's going on. Like he's not playing along with any joke. He's not going, like, he legitimately wants to know what BOFA what? Like he can't fathom that he doesn't know it. So you've got to explain it to him. And that's when you drop the hammer on him.
And I mean the best part was is like then he just that guy who did it to him followed up with like immediately like 5 seconds after it with like you are now blocked from following. So you just imagine like Richard Dawkins just sitting there like refreshing his notifications like I can't wait to find out what this BOFA is, and then he's like BOFA these nuts, and he's like what?
I've been had.
I don't know. They got the best of me. They must be Christians.
Out of here.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Somebody's like dead. It'd have to be somebody like the best person to get. It had to be like Maya Angelou or somebody. It would be like my best one. Like you just hit her with it, and she's like, BOFA what, my child? And you're like, I don't want to have to do this to you, Maya. And then you drop the hammer.
So is an in person or live like voice BOFA better than a like tweet or text BOFA? Like let's say Warren Buffett came to your college and came to speak there. And it's at the question and answer phase, and Warren Buffett's sitting there up on stage. He's worth how many billions of dollars? Second wealthiest person in the United States. Now we're taking questions, and you just stand up and you go, have you thought about investing any of your money into BOFA charitable funds? And then, you know, Buffett just like, what does that mean?
He's like an 85-year-old. He's just racking it. Bro, BOFA? He looks to like his advisor. BOFA? Do we do any business with BOFA?
See, I think that's like... I think that would breathe new life into BOFA if people would start, like, videotaping them doing it instead of just doing it on Twitter. Because what I can't stand is, like, people will force a BOFA, and that's just
yeah.
worse. Like, you'll say, like, have you read the BOFA report? And the person's like, I'm not going to tweet at you anymore. And then they're going to come back and say, well, BOFA. No, the person has to specifically ask what BOFA is.
Well, yeah, that, yeah, I've seen people, like, lead with it. Like, somebody got... Or tried to get... Oh, no, they got Joe Rogan. And what's... I think they had, like, you have to get him in a conversation. Like, a back and forth. You can't just at Donald Trump and be like, did you read the BOFA report? Like, you have to get him some type of engaging to know that you've got him. But I don't know. Like, the setup of seeing it, like, on Twitter or in text, like, when you get the perfect setup, might trump the live card. Just because, like, everybody knows what's coming, except for the person.
Yeah, and kind of being there live in that anticipation phase, and then, you know, also, like, the you know, the picture, the four-panel pictures you choose is very critical to
yes,
it as well.
Yes, absolutely.
It's funny, you just, like, I, like, mentally, every time Joe Rogan, like, is brought up or I read his name, like, I immediately think of the Chappelle Show. Like, it's ruined Joe Rogan for me for the rest of, like, anytime I see him on UFC or whatever, anytime someone... talks, I just think about hey, Joe Rogan.
I was thinking about that skit earlier today, and the part that cracks me up where he's like, no, Tyrone, these coals are very hot. They're upwards of 2,000 degrees. God damn. And that always killed me for like, that just killed me for like 10 years for some reason.
Oh, man. But, I mean, like, anytime I hear someone say Joe Rogan, I just immediately think, hey, Joe Rogan. And that Tyrone voice. I just, like, it's so funny. Like, there's got to be, like, lots of people like me that think that, too, that Joe Rogan's just been ruined for them for life because of Dave Chappelle.
Oh, absolutely. Joe Rogan, I feel like anytime Wayne Brady comes up around my mother, she mentions the Wayne Brady skit every single time.
And, like, I remember, like, watching those when they would, like, premiere on Comedy Central. And, like, that, I mean, like, at that point in time, like, for him to have Wayne Brady on there was just so hilarious, because that was still, like, when Wayne Brady, I mean, that was the humor of it, but, like, I think, like, people who are, you know, like, watching it on YouTube now, like, you know, Wayne Brady isn't as much in the, you know, pop culture.
Yeah, it's like, you can't replicate, one, how big he was, and two, like, the image he had. So for him to even show up, I remember it being like, oh, shit, that's really Wayne Brady.
And it was hilarious. I mean, right. You know, it was like the same, you know, like the Neil Patrick Harris character 180 that he did in the Harold and Kumar movies. And, like, you know, like, anytime you get, like, the actual person there doing a 180 thing, like, it's always going to be funny to me, because at least says that person has a good enough sense of humor to go along with them.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, like, Wayne Brady was on TV, like, five nights a week. He was doing, like, Whose Line Is It? And then I think he was doing a game show for a while, and he had his own variety show. I mean, like, Wayne Brady was the face of ABC. Like, you know, just, like, everyone loved Wayne Brady, and then, like, all of a sudden, like, out of nowhere, he's on Chappelle's Show just doing all that funny shit. I gotta go back and watch those. They were great.
Yeah, like, I'll catch, like, a marathon on every once in a while, and I'm like, holy shit, this is, like, I was in high school when Chappelle's Show came out. I was like, and this stuff is still hilarious. Like, it doesn't, sometimes it's even funnier, like, when you see some of the stuff that he is, like some of the Black Bush stuff, or the Black President stuff. Anything that he was like, damn, Dave Chappelle was right.
Well, like, I mean, so much of it, like, I mean, like, a lot of, like, my favorite thing is when they do, it's the spouse swap or the husband swap or whatever.
With Leonard Washington.
Yeah. But, you know, he's playing the white husband, and he goes in and, like, licks the bra, and he just smacks his lips and goes,
titty residue.
Like, I mean, just, like, the way it's delivered, the comedic timing, like, the verbiage, like, titty residue, like, the way the words sound by himself is just, like, hilarious. Like, and that's what he was just so good at. Like, he just had a way to make everything funny, and it's, like, a lot of the stuff is, like, some of the stuff's based on, like, a lot of dated pop cultural references, but it's amazing because it's still funny.
Yeah, like, that, and another one from that episode... where he's laying with, like, the new wife, and she's like, are you going to take your boxers off? Can I just pull my penis through this hole?
Oh, or when that kid's listening to, like, 50 Cent, and he's like, pregnant. He takes him on the drive, pushes him out the car. He's like, get out.
Yeah, Leonard Washington was a top, maybe a top three Chappelle character. Like, he batted 1,000 for me, at least.
Yeah. And then the Mad Real World is also that's a good one too.
Oh man, what favorite Chappelle skit?
Favorite Chappelle skit? Oh man, I know it's cliche, but it's got to be the Charlie Murphy Rick James one.
Yeah, I think that it is cliche, but I remember exactly. I was talking to my mother on the phone watching that, and I remember her asking me what was wrong because I was laughing that hard.
I mean, I think what made it funny was you like, unlike the Prince one, they actually had like interview with Rick James interspersed with it, right?
Right.
So Rick James was there, you know, for the production and had the sign off, and then was like watching it, and probably like, yeah, this is pretty accurate to reality. You're like an enhanced version of reality.
Yeah, more or less.
I mean, and you think about like you had both "I'm Rick James, bitch," which like people still will repeat that to this day in various formats or whatever, and you had "fuck your couch." Like, yeah. That skit launched two. You know, and I think it's you know, better known for the catchphrases, but like itself, it's just this portrayal of Rick James and you know, Charlie Murphy. It was just like so hilarious. You know, there's so many other ones. I mean, even the like Clayton Bigsby was, you know, like that was a hell of a way to like start the show off. I mean,
yeah, I'm trying to think. Bigsby was a good one. The Tyrone Biggs one, where he goes to the school to talk to the kids, was always a personal favorite. Where he's like, you go in your mama's purse, you take a little $20, you go down to the D train, you ask for Manuel, and it cuts to the kid in the audience just writing everything down.
That's such a, I mean, yeah, like, you know, it's funny because, like, looking back on it, like at the time, you know, went about 3 seasons, and then, you know, Chappelle just kind of walked away from it. And
yeah.
He came to my school in 2004. Five, I think it was like either at the tail end of the show or like when the show was popular, and you know, it's a college crowd and it's like a, you know, it's a big university, and the people go, they were all drunk and they're just wanting it, like they're like being very disrespectful and yelling like, say Rick James and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you could, like, when he goes into the interviews and talks about like how people were like saying like, you know, the reason it's funny isn't because it's this and this. Like, you're thinking it's funny because it's something it's not. And, you know, like, I could see it firsthand because, like, everyone was just, like, in it for, you know, the catchphrases and stuff like that. And so I'm kind of glad it was just, like, it really had no decline. That last season was, like, I mean, they had to do something weird with, like, the way it was, like, cut and stuff like that. But, like, those, I mean, the first 2 seasons were phenomenal, and you know, I'm kind of glad he stopped doing them because it is like there's nothing that really missed on the show.
Yeah, and it's like at the time, you know, like I couldn't believe it. Who would turn down $50 million on that? And like the older I got, I'm like, I understand it perfectly. I understand it perfectly.
Well, I mean, and the thing is, like, you know, that was, you know, becoming one of the biggest shows for Comedy Central, and like the more attention you get, the more money your show's going to make, the bigger audience you get, and the more someone else is going to want to come in and have more creative control over it.
Right.
You know, just kind of taper it for that bigger audience and to, you know, maybe make it or desensitize it or, you know, maybe clean it up a little bit in the way they see fit. And, you know, did Chappelle, you know, walked away from that because he wanted ownership of it. I mean, one of the reasons, I had to assume. So, you know, it's just like, it's funny because I go back and watch those and like, not only are they, like, you know, still funny today, but they're just so ahead of their time.
Yeah.
In a lot of different sense. And, you know, the comedy and the, like, just the delivery, it's like, it's not even dated at all. It's incredible. Like, it just kind of speaks to the guy and, like, how funny he is.
Yeah. I don't know. I was trying to think. I don't really remember looking forward to anything like the way I did, like, Chappelle's show. Because it was like middle of the week. Like Wednesday or Thursday, whatever, and it was like, stop what you're doing. It's 9:30 or whatever time it came on. Chappelle's show's coming on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we would, you know, I was a freshman in college. We'd all get in one person's dorm room and like be like 8 of us watching Chappelle. it was like must see TV at the time. Now, like, we all did that for Family Guy too, so that doesn't mean it's a good show. But.
To be fair.
But yeah, I mean, I just, like, you know, like I said, like, the whole Joe Rogan experience has been ruined for me because of Dave Chappelle, kind of in the same way. Like, when I think of Wayne Brady or Charlie Murphy, or, well, I wouldn't even think of Charlie Murphy if it wasn't for Chappelle, so I don't feel too bad.
I'll tell you another one. And I think he's a funny person. I won't say ruined, but anytime I see Bill Burr, I always think about the World Series of Dice, and he's like, I knew they were coming, so I put my car keys up my own asshole. That's what I think of that every time I see Bill Burr. It never fails.
I forgot about the World Series of Dice.
That's a classic.
That's definitely up there too. God, there's so many of them. I'm gonna go back and watch some of them tonight. That's gonna be my nightly activity, I think.
I think you should one or two episodes a night just to close out the day.
Well, there was Rembert on when he was, I think it was still with Grantland, did like this ranking of like all the Chappelle shows.
Yeah, the tournament. I remember that.
Yeah, which was like, it was awesome. So I might go back and just like sequentially watch that if I get to the archives and lock them down or whatever.
Well, I'd seen, like, they're selling them online, like, for cheap. Like, all three seasons, I saw, like, Fat Kid deals or whatever. Like, all three seasons for, like, $12.
Yeah. I might just buy them, man. I might just support Dave Chappelle monetarily.
There you go. That's the thing. I like how, like, our last resort is, like, I guess I'll buy it. Like, if I can't find it any other way, I guess I'll put some money in the guy's pocket.
The funny part is it's become such like a noble act to say you're going to pay for media. It's like, you know what? I'm going to do them a favor. I'm going to buy their album.
I'm going to buy this J. Cole album with no feature or whatever it is you're buying.
Hey, have you heard that album has no features?
I heard a rumor. I don't know how you hear anything on Twitter, man.
I might just go out and because I like the artist so much, I might just spend $1.99 on iTunes.
I might go to FYE after I get paid this Friday and purchase a physical compact disc. I might.
Have you ever been back in one of those places?
Do they still have those places?
Like, I swear, like within the last 3 years, I was in one and I forget where I was. And it was just, it was funny because they shifted half the store to have like video games and like pop culture stuff, but they still have like compact discs there. Mm. I want to know who's going in there for compact discs, and I just want to meet them at the door and be like, hey, all right, get this.
Right, like what?
It's called Spotify, right?
I can help you. Like, for the price of this one CD, you can listen to every song ever made. I think I'll still roll with the compact disc.
Yeah, no, it's like, I have a 6-disc changer in my Honda, so I need to stick with CDs. It's like, well, have you heard about the CD burner?
Not interested. No, thank you.
Well, it's funny. My dad has an older car, and he doesn't have an aux cable on it. And it's like funny because it's 2005, and a lot of cars from 2005 even have those. But you still have to. He has this adapter that's a cassette tape with the aux cord coming out of the cassette.
Oh man, that's classy.
Oh man, they're like those things are the biggest pain in the ass to use because you have to find the right equilibrium of volume on the MP3 player and volume on the car radio without making it sound like complete garbage. I always give them a hard time when I use that, but I would be willing to bet those are sold in FYE. So
it's got. I used to have the grown up version of that. I had like the iPod holder which plugged into the cigarette lighter, and you had to put it on like some radio station that had no frequency to hear the song, and that was how I used to listen to iPod and the first car I ever had.
Oh man,
it was just horrendous.
I remember that too. It never really worked on my car. It's kind of crazy, like thinking back, and that was only like, I don't know, 9 years ago, maybe less.
Right,
because we had this like, you know, we had this like, because like car technology like floats behind. Like 5 or 6 years, so like it didn't really catch up to like the whole iPod movement, and then like by the time it did catch up, you know, now everything has Bluetooth and stuff like that, but you know, now people are going to want to just do Spotify straight from their car menu and stuff, and who knows, be like, and only 90s kids will get that and appreciate it.
People forget how we used to the means we have to go to listen to music in our cars.
Just have to buy it. You just have to like actually open up a package and put it into the CD player, it sucked.
Like, I remember, like, selling. I would burn and sell CDs at school and just keeping it, like, low profile, like I was selling drugs. I would just have, like five Lil Jon CDs in my backpack, just hoping that somebody would want to give me, like, $5 for a burnt Lil Jon Crunk Juice CD. And, hey, that fed my kids, man. That got me through high school selling knockoff CDs. So I'm thankful for it.
Man, I'm stupid because I just gave them away. I wanted people to like me.
You fool.
I had this huge pirated music collection, which at the time was huge, but now I look back, it's only like 6 gigabytes. The 6 gigabytes in like 2002 was like incredible. Like, it's like half a hard drive, man. So what I would do is I needed to back them up, so I went to the store and I got a big spindle of CDRs. And I think CDRs had, you know, like a 512 megabyte capacity or something.
Big
like
time.
That. So I just sat there, you know, just casually burning like 12 CDRs just back to back, thinking this was like a good use of my time. And then my friends always wanted these CDRs. They're like, oh, give me all your music collection, your libraries. I'd go over and I'd wait for them to load up all 12 CDs onto their hard drive and then drag it over. And I should have just been selling it. I should have been like, look, man, like $30. You have my music collection. You want the Chumbawamba? You got to pay for it.
It's not free. Tough Thumping is not free, motherfucker.
Yeah, you want all these comedy songs that are labeled as Weird Al, but not by Weird Al? Go for it. You got
to
pay.
I used to sell CDs, and I used to, like, another guy used to buy, he used to sell them. But he was selling for $2. So I would just go buy his and then sell them for $5. I was just cutting, like, the middleman, and the middleman here being hard work, out of the equation altogether. So,
that's a smart business.
Hey, I was trying efficiency. My PER was high. I'm trying to think, man. I feel like that's a pretty good way to go out, reminiscing about CDRs and, like, waiting 45 minutes for a 12-track CD to burn.
I'll have one more anecdote on like how crappy, it's like, you know, everyone views like 1999 to 2001 as like this huge technology boom. And like it was, but like all these interfaces for every device you got were so poor. You tried to install them, like nothing would work. Like nothing would work with your drivers. You had to get new drivers. You had to go out to the internet. You didn't know where to find them. Google really wasn't Google. So you actually had to put effort into it. But, my first MP3 player was something called the Rio Diamond.
Jesus Christ.
Personal music player.
That sounds unclassy.
Had a 32 megabyte capacity on it, meaning you could put about like 12 songs on it. I thought this was the dopest shit ever because I could take any selection of 12 songs that I wanted and put this on my personal music player and take it to school.
They take it wherever you wanted, man.
And you know what? It wasn't just me. Everyone was so impressed by it. But I look back at like all these, like, you know, we get all this music streaming and unlimited streaming music and all this stuff. And I was like walking around with this 32 megabyte MP3 player. And before that, I used to have mini discs. Do you know what those are?
Mini? I feel like that, like my sister is older. I feel like she had those. Those are a little bit before my time.
Yeah. So it's like the Sony proprietary format that was kind of like a hybrid between a cassette, like a floppy disk and a CD.
And a CD, yeah.
But what you had to do is you had to link it up to your computer and you had to like record the song like you would on a tape deck.
Jesus Christ.
It could hold a lot of time, but I would literally just sit there and play song after song after song after song after song in order to load them all on my mini disc player. And I thought this was an efficient use of my time.
Yeah, it seemed right. Stupid.
My parents were just like watching me in the room. It's like, I hope this kid turns out okay.
I'm sure you were beating the women off with a stick at that point.
Yeah, I was trying to get them to listen to Afro Man because I got my mini disc player.
Gee, I feel like all this stuff cycles though. Like somebody's gonna try to be hip and retro, and all that shit's gonna come back around.
No, it's already started with the vinyl. You know, everyone makes the arguments for the vinyls, but I just, you know, it's just not convenient. That's what it comes back to me. It's like I do whatever is gonna make me the happiest with the least amount of effort.
Correct.
So if that's me streaming a song, it's fine. I don't need to drop a Beatles album on the vinyl to try to impress anyone.
Right. It's like
shit.
Yeah, it's like the sound quality is so much better. I'm like, yeah, but I have to like sit down and like if I want to listen to song number 8, where the fuck do I drop the needle, man? Like, can I just put it on my phone?
Like, I wouldn't even come over to your house if I wasn't so drunk right now. So why do I want to, like, I can't tell the difference of your songs.
I'm not an audiophile. I don't fuck albums, so I don't know what sounds good and what doesn't sound good. Can I just like push Apple Music and they give me the song I want, please?
Oh, Google search, can I fuck an album?
I don't know if we're gonna top that.
I think that's a good way to go out, man.
I think that's a good way.
It's been an honor. And sorry, I talk a lot, but it's been good. And thanks for letting me discuss LeBron and OJ, and then I kind of derailed the show with my own comments.
No, no, not a problem. Thank you for joining us, sir.
I enjoy your tweets, and I thank you for your good content. I appreciate you entertaining me for the evening. So thank you, man.
Not a problem, man. The feeling is mutual. I appreciate you and your brands. I'm looking forward to what's like every year. On September 10th, I always hope it comes back, but then I was like, that was a shooting star, man. That was perfect timing, everything.
It's a pop-up shop.
At one time.
Micro brand.
Exactly. But I appreciate you. I'm a big fan of you, and thank you for joining me, sir.
Yeah, the feeling's mutual, man. Thank you so much.
All right, and with that said, that brings show number 83 to a conclusion. As always, I want to thank you guys so much for rocking with me these first 83 shows. I want to thank my man Trill Ballins for joining me. By now, you know where to find the show. If you go to SoundCloud, Stitcher, as well as iTunes, search for Trill Withers. The show will come up. Do me a favor. Go ahead and subscribe so that the show will come to you every week. Got the email address. That's TrillWithersPodcast@gmail.com. Again, TrillWithersPodcast@gmail.com. As always, guys, thanks so much for the support. Stay righteous.